I'm delighted now to welcome Godfrey Reggio. He is an award-winning filmmaker. His new film, Visitors, opens at the Screen Friday the 31st of January at 7 in the evening here in Santa Fe. Welcome to Radio Cafe.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
So this film, to me, was like a long kind of wordless visual poem. It's black and white. It has a total of 74 shots. It's hard to definitively say what it's about, although I have my own ideas of what it's about. How did you approach this project? How did it begin?
The project began in 2003, a year after the release of Nakoikatsi, the film that I last did before this. It took 9 years in development. It took 9 years because I was looking for the finances to do this. This film is like a cat that barks, so it's very hard to find people willing to make an investment in something like this. In fact, most of the films I've done have been funded by angels rather than investors, people who do it for love of the project, who are not interested necessarily in financial recoupment, though that does happen as well.
So even though you have a history of these very hard-to-classify films being financially successful, people are still skittish because they don't know what to call it? Like, is this a documentary? Is this a...
Right. Well, you know, there are many of us that have different kind of culinary taste, depending on what we like. The same thing could be said for cinema. However, cinema today is principally theatrical. Let's say 9 out of 8 films are theatrical. That means they have a clear story, a plot, characterization. In the films that I've been involved in, all of the foreground of traditional cinema is taken out, the characterization, the plot, the storyline, and what's called in the business second unit production becomes the foreground. So the background becomes the foreground. So we would shoot a building like you would shoot a Class A actor, rather than in a documentary sense. In that sense, these films are different from what people expect when they go to a theater. An analogy would be you go to a hamburger stand, you expect to have a piece of meat on the burger. In this case, metaphorically, there's no meat on the burger, but there's something else. So I always suggest to people, if they wish to go to see these films, to please leave their expectations at the door. This film is more about poetic cinema, and poetic cinema is not something that is there to entertain, explain, or give information. It's something to affect the viewer. So it's not a logical or a conceptual base that puts it together. It's non-linear. It's more about pictorial composition. And as all of us know, we all see the picture differently. So if 100 people come to see this film, and let's say the first 15 leave because they can't find that metaphoric hamburger on the bun, for the rest of the 75 or 85 that are there, there certainly will be that many different points of view about this film. The subject of visitors is the audience watching the film. In that sense, the film is autodidactic. The person who watches the film, she becomes at once the storyteller, the character, and the plot of visitors.
Well, it's a very interesting thing because, I mean, what you're doing is telling us that we have to bring a lot to this film, and I certainly had that experience as I was watching the film in the preview recently, yet you bring a lot to us too. And so there's that interplay between what you give and then what we bring to it.
Right. Well, it's all about what you bring to it, as you said. Let's look at it as going to see a painting at a museum. If all of us had the same point of view about the painting, then it probably wouldn't be art. It would probably be advertising or propaganda. The beauty of this is that it's in the eye of the beholder. One has to stand in front of a painting and not only look at the painting, but let the painting look at you. In this film, it's about the reciprocal gaze. Not only do you look at the screen, but the screen is definitely looking back at you. It sets up a wholly different dynamic in terms of viewing.
There were a lot of shots, and by no means all of them, but a large part of the movie was what look at first like still photographs of people, but they're actually moving images. It looks like they're in slow motion. I'm not sure if that's actually the case.
Yes, they are. Normally, the norm in film is 24 frames a second. These portraits were shot at 48 plus frames a second, which is slow motion. However, the, as it were, the point of view of the film is called the moving still. The image that you'll see at the beginning of the shot, because the camera is moving almost inhumanly slow towards the subject, will be a different shot that you see at the end. But because it's moving so slow, you almost, by blinking an eye, can miss that the camera is moving. In that sense, it sets up an opportunity for the audience that sees this to see those faces in a different way. And again, as I said, we're not only looking at those faces, they're looking at us. In traditional cinema, one of the things that is not allowed, though there are exceptions, is for the actors to look directly into the lens. What that does is break the voyeuristic experience of the audience. The audience can be watching anything from intense love to murder to violence to joy, but always through that metaphoric keyhole, as it were, as a voyeur. When the actors or when the subjects of the film are directly in gaze with you, it changes the whole dynamic. In that sense, this film is really off the charts for theatrical films.
It can be almost disconcerting at times to have these huge faces staring at you when you're sitting in the audience. And it was like, I almost felt like I should look down at times. But I was like, no, this is a film. They're not actually really looking at me. I had to sort of remind myself what the context was. But it's sort of strangely intimate. And I wondered, I mean, who were these people? How did you choose the people that you have in this film?
Well, all these people are what are called in the business extras. They work in the second unit, basically. They're background to the story and the plot. In this case,
but they're extra. They're in the film business.
They're in. Well, they volunteer. Others we picked up on street corners in New Orleans, workers that were waiting to go to work and didn't have a job that day. Some of them sign up as extras. Others are brought to us through friends. So none of the people that you see in the film are actors per se, because the direction given to them is that they do nothing more than they ordinarily do. In this case, we wanted no one acting. We wanted all the people that are looking at you to be in a non-self-conscious state. So, for example, some people are just sitting for a portrait. They're not told what to think, what to do. They're asked only to look into the lens of the camera. That's the first six shots. The other shots that follow, starting with children watching television, then going into gamers, then going into a sports bar, these are all people that knew they were being filmed, but as soon as that television comes on or the game comes on, then the TV is like a tractor beam. It takes them right out of themselves. They're looking at screens, remember? We're filming right through the screen through a two-way mirror. They knew they were being filmed, but they were only doing what they normally did. We filmed probably 150 people to have a handful of people on the screen, because all of the people that you're going to see are not acting for you. They're responding to something that is in front of them that you don't see, this predicate, as it were, the screen that all of us are addicted to. So for children, you'll see eye behavior, facial display, emotional automaticities passing through the face, almost at hurricane speed. These are things that you can't ask someone to do. It has to be coming from them.
They, to me, transcend the categories of things like beauty and ugliness. There's all ages there. It's so human, and it's also really kind of timeless, because you see these faces, there's usually a I think, black background, whether it be a crowd scene or individual, and you don't know what time you're in, and so that engagement between the audience and that person is, it made me think of the title of the film, Visitors. I was thinking these people whom you shoot in the film are visitors, as I am a visitor on this planet for some short time. And I was thinking as I was watching them, you know, this child, this old person, we're all going to die, and we don't know whether we have 10 years on this life or 97.
Right. Well, the term visitors is a ubiquitous term. It's in all cultures, from cultures of orality to literate cultures. The meaning of visitors is up to those that use the term, but the etymology of the word means to come to see. And this is what this film is about, to come to see. What you see is in the eye of the beholder. It's, again, like a painting. If everyone saw the same thing in the painting, it wouldn't be that interesting. What is the meaning of the Mona Lisa? That would be a ridiculous question. It's up to the viewer to have that response. So we all are visitors. We could be visitors to the planet, we could be visitors to the movie, we could be visitors to a party, etc. Visitors is such an open term that you're free to put any meaning on it you wish. Also, all of us wear a face of a mask within us all. These people, while different from us, we're all united as human beings, as human animals. So to look into the face of another, to look into the face of another human animal, to look into the face of a gorilla, is perhaps an opportunity to see ourselves in a different way for the first time. Lauren Isley says that we have not seen ourselves until we've been seen through the eyes of another animal. In this film, there are 2.5 primates, as it were, in a pew. A gorilla, humans, and cyborgs. In this case, the gorilla is the adult in the room. She is the witness. She is the strong person, as it were, the diva of the film. Humans, the audience, we're the real King Kong. We're like hanging by our tails from the trees. And the other people in the film, cyborgs, you and me and everyone existing today, not the cyborgs of science fiction, but the cyborgs of the fiction of science. It's in the relationship of those three groups that the film finds its dynamic.
We're talking to filmmaker Godfrey Reggio. Can you tell us a little more about this gorilla?
Yes.
The film starts and ends with the gorilla, and she's also in the middle.
Yes. This is just a point of view, but working with my colleague Ray Jimenez for 9 years before the film was actually started, we had a lot of time to feel what is the kind of entities we wanted in the film. Both of us, after studying, felt that the female lowland gorilla, her face and our face are most similar. Even though we're genetically similar, more similar to the chimpanzee, they tell us, at least in terms of visage, we're much closer in appearance to the lowland female gorilla. Now, had we shot that female gorilla in Uganda, it would look like we were looking at a gorilla in Uganda. If we shot it just as it was in the Bronx Zoo, where they spent $30 million to make it look like an African Congo village of gorillas, it would have looked like a gorilla in the village. So what I realized early on is that if we take the background out of the gorilla, if we put the gorilla in the background, then no longer are we looking at a gorilla. A gorilla is looking at us, and through the veracity of her eyes, through the clarity of what clearly is an intelligent face, we get to see ourselves in a manner that perhaps we've never seen ourselves before.
And the fact that she frames the film she's the, I think, the only one who we see more than once. I mean, there's so many possible interpretations of that. There's so many metaphors of what that means. And I mean, I was thinking before I talked to you, may I ask you whether you have an interpretation of that, or is it really you're leaving it up to us?
No, well, I leave it up to you, please. But what I want to say is this, that if we put a frame around something, if we border it, we then have this propensity to conjure meaning. If you go to an art gallery, there are many different kinds of painters, many different kinds of frames. But the second you put a frame, it's our tendency to conjure meaning because of that frame. The equivalent of a frame for this film, in a larger sense, are bookends. If you begin the film the way you end the film, then that sets up the possibility for us to start searching at some point, probably after we leave the film, for what the film is. Now, I want to say this. If you go see Visitors and you're looking for the meaning of the film, you will probably miss everything that is there. I suggest, like a good traveler, that you sit back in your chair and just take in the sights. Let it wash over you. That's what we do when we travel. There's nothing extraordinary about that. But we're so used to going to cinema where the story is to be told. This is a story to behold. So it's one where if you let go of that, if you let go of your expectation, if you stop looking for meaning, then you have the possibility to have an experience. Let me give another example of this. If you went out to, the edge of Santa Fe, looking towards the west at sunset with your sweetheart, you wouldn't ask her or him, what is the meaning of the sunset today? It would be a kind of a ridiculous question. The sunset has no meaning, however, it can be meaningful. This film is to give you an experience of the subject. Frequently, the films that I've done with my colleagues have been called experimental because people don't know how to define what they are. They don't fit into the normal categories of traditional cinema or documentary. So if you let that go, you then allow yourself to see it in another way. It doesn't have a category to fit into. In that sense, it could be seen as a cine monad beyond the traditional boundaries of definition.
To use the sunset example, the sunset was not composed consciously by Godfrey Reggio, right? No. You have composed a film. You bring to it your heart. You bring to it your experience, your age, your love, your sense of mystery, your aesthetic. And so all of those things are what we're looking at. It's not a kind of semi-random act of nature.
Right.
It's something that you are giving us. And I mean, it's like the example of going to an art museum and trying to understand or trying to feel what the painter is giving you. The painter had a whole life, and the painter had all sorts of ideas and intentions and hopes for what that would give you.
Right. Well, this is just an opinion again, but my opinion is that in art, all meaning is in the form. And if art is real, which means if it's not stillborn, if it has a life beyond the time it was made, then it takes on its own life, and it overcomes the inadequacies, the mistakes, the ego, whatever might distract from the clarity of what you're trying to do in creating this art. All of that is overcome by the art itself. So it has much more to say than I put into it. In effect, without sounding ridiculous, art has a voice of its own. I look at this film as an artopsy, to see with one's own eyes the world in which we live. For me, the world in which we live is perhaps, if this doesn't sound too hard, more real than true. So, of course, I try to make a film that's more true than real. I know that sounds like a double entendre, mixing words around. All I'm trying to say is that these films are beyond what we can speak about. They affect, for those that can bear it, everyone in a different way. While the intention of the film is to affect the audience, to watermark the audience, to touch the audience, once the audience leaves, what's in the head of the viewer is going to be vastly different person to person. My intention is to affect people so that they can go back and, as it were, taste that reflection in retrospect.
You used a term a moment ago, artopsy.
Right. That's just a play on words instead of an autopsy. This okay. is an artopsy, to see with one's own eyes through the vehicle of art. Art, you know, again, a point of view has been hijacked by the art market, by the art mafia. But art can be in the public place. It can be available to all. All of us have that within us. This film in particular, is designed to awaken within us that which is already present, what I call the aesthetic triplets of sensation, emotion, and perception. It's to awaken those three beautiful qualities that are always inside of all of us. And using aesthetics rather than a linear story is the way that I try to evoke those presences.
We're talking to filmmaker Godfrey Reggio about his new film, Visitors. When you said more real than true, I was thinking about, as I was watching the film, in a way, it's so produced, it's so stylized. I mean, we don't hear the actual sounds that are going on in what would have been that scene. We hear Philip Glass music. The camera is so very smooth, while our perception of the world is much bumpier. The background is completely black or sometimes completely white, and that's not real either. And all of those, in a way, give an effect that allows you to take out the extraneous and focus just on one thing.
Yes. Well, that's the intention. Again, there's a great Latin term, quid recipitur. One receives according to their vessel or their bowl. Each person is different. For some people, it's unbearable. For other people, they can't get enough of it. We're all different. That's the beauty of life. There are many paths to the source. The source in this case is the film, the path, or all the people that watch it. Again, it's an autodidactic form. It's one that, again, where the viewer herself, himself, becomes the screenplay, the storyteller, the character, and the plot of the film. Also, since I keep using the word art, let me get a little more into it. I try to use what's called the perfected image. That doesn't mean it's perfect. It just means that we're trying to craft it as perfectly as possible. The reason for that is the following, that at least from my point of view, beauty reveals a truth. And beauty, the very origin of the word beauty in its etymology in Greek is kalos. However, the etymology of kalos shares the word kalios, which means to provoke. Art is not something tranquil. Art can, and in my opinion, should provoke, if not shock, its viewers. I also feel for this film and for the other films I've done, a basic point of view, that not only the blind cannot see, not only the deaf cannot hear, all of us live in a world whereby that which is most present is least observable by virtue of its presence. So that which is most familiar, ordinary, normal, those are the things that we're surrounded with daily, but they become the things most difficult to see by virtue of that presence. These films are an attempt to take that ordinariness, kids on television sets, people gaming, people watching the Final Four basketball game, looking at a gorilla, things that are not normal to do, but that we take for granted for the sake of our behavior. These are the assumptions, as it were, we make for the sake of our behavior. These films are an attempt to show us that which is hidden in plain sight, that which we don't see again by virtue of its constant presence before us.
The music in the film is by Philip Glass, with whom you've collaborated in a number of other films, starting with Koyaanisqatsi of 1982. I was wondering, what is the process? How do you put together the music and the visual? How do you work with the composer?
Well, let me back up a bit. The process for all of the collaborators, including Philip and the other associates I work with, is collaboration. Let me say this, that my own inadequacies are most clear to me, so I always try to work with people more talented than I, because it's a collaborative forum. In art, probably the most difficult way to do art is through collaboration. In the films that I do, certainly for myself, Philip, all the other people I work with, we all have very large egos. I think ego is important because it gives strength to the person. But if you're in a collaborative forum, one cannot have vanity of ego. To work with Philip Glass, a person very well known now for his beautiful compositions, a person that has a reputation all over the planet, many people like Phil and others, especially others, are surrounded by people who tell them what they'd like to hear. Working in a critical forum, in a collaborative forum, one has to be able to take criticism. I've worked with Philip Glass now for over 35 years. He is not only willing, he elicits that criticism. He wants to see what we think. Not that he has to agree with it, but he's willing to be in that critical forum, which makes him a terrific collaborator in films like this. When composers work in cinema, normally they do what are called music cues. Those could be anywhere from a few seconds to as long as several minutes. In the case of the relationship I have with Philip Glass, I'm asking him to make a full symphonic score that covers the entire length of the film. In the case of Visitors, 87 minutes and 33 seconds. That's a much different assignment. His music, in effect, becomes the emotive armchair, or if you want, in quotes, the dialogue, the emotive dialogue for the film. So his participation is as critical as the image itself. It's like looking at the body. We have a bilateral body. He's one. Without Philip Glass, there would be no film. Without the image, there would be no thing for Philip to write, but they're co-equal in their participation. He's not just knocking off music cues that the music editor or the director can take and move all over the place. So in the case of Philip, he always likes to go on as many locations as possible to get the original hit. He was there when we filmed Trishka at the Bronx Zoo. He was in the Atchafalaya swamps of Louisiana when we were filming, in the ruins of New Orleans in southern Louisiana. He gets a hit on that. He also then comes to my studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn. He lives in Manhattan. They're like on different planets, but that's another story. And I ask him not to write note one until he's been completely marinated in the ethos, the point of view, the emotion, and most especially the visualizations that we have selected from the immense amount of footage that we shot. We make selects. We then, Philip comes over, sees all of those selects. I then write what's called the dramaturgical shaping of the film, which is the equivalent of a rough cut. We put that together. He sees that. Let's say there are eight discrete pieces of music, in this case for the film of Visitors. We don't tell him to start with the first piece and go continuously all the way through eight. What we ask him to do is wherever he would like to begin, please start. He starts writing on his piano with pencil and paper. He doesn't use a computer. I usually go over to his studio first, hear it on the piano, make any comments I wish at that time. When we agree that we're close to something that is interesting for the film and works for him and works for the film, it then is put on an emulator with digitally recorded instruments. We then can bring it into the studio. It's not the recording. These are just digital files that we can make a faux recording out of. We then start editing with that. There are always changes. Sometimes there are rejections of pieces of music. not because they're not interesting, but because they're not. It's like a dancing partner. If we're going to be dancing together and the foxtrot is the music or the samba, we both have to be in that orientation, though both of us doing our own separate moves.
So the music was played by the Linz Orchestra of Austria. When, I mean, was that late in the game that that recording was made?
Once the process would be the following, to repeat, Philip being marinated, going in locations, coming to the studio, seeing the selects, looking at the dramaturgical structure that's being put together. Once he starts writing the music, it's committed to emulation. We have the equivalent of a soundtrack to work with in the edit. Once we lock that down, only at that point, when everything is locked, then we can do the actual recording. In this case, myself and crew members went to Linz, Austria. Dennis Russell Davies is the conductor there. It's called the Bruckner Orchestra. It's the home of Bruckner, actually, his former home. And they do the recording. It's at that time that the recording is then taken and put on to the film, married to the film, as it were. It's also after that that we do all of the color correction for the film to make sure that everything is exactly the way it's intended to look. And then we also do the, once it's all recorded, we do the final mix of the film so that we can have input to the dynamic range. At that point, the two mediums are fused together into what's called the final film. So it is a long process, and that's usually the editing. The shooting is called production of the film. The editing is called post-production. The color correction, the music recording, and final mix is called the post-production.
We're talking to filmmaker Godfrey Reggio about his new film, Visitors. Now, a lot of the film, or a good portion of it, was shot in Louisiana, which is where you're from. And one thing I've been thinking about more and more as I live in New Mexico is, for example, people who are from New Mexico or have lived here for a very long time have a kind of more depth that they bring to, for example, photography than somebody who's visiting this place for the first time and being overwhelmed by the beautiful landscape. And I wondered what being in your home, your ancestral home,
right,
is like as a filmmaker.
Well, while I've lived in Santa Fe now, my home has been here for 55 years, and while I don't live in New Orleans, while I'm not there, New Orleans is in me. It's in my nervous system, in my blood, in my history. So I'm watermarked, as it were, by New Orleans, as I am now by Santa Fe. Two extreme places in the United States. One of the highest deserts on the planet, and the other one of the most, one of the newest land masses on the planet. Actually, at the time of Christ, it was actually being formed by the effluvial mud and waters that came through the Mississippi. In Louisiana, you don't walk on land, you walk on kind of spongy land because it's marshland, it's water, everything dissolves. It's very moving to me. I'm not advocating it, I'm just saying that it's a part of who I am. I've always wanted to film in Louisiana. My family was born my father was born less than 2 miles from the Atchafalaya Basin. He's a part Cajun man. I lived in my adolescence as a young Christian brother, a junior novice in Lafayette, Louisiana, between Lafayette and Breaux Bridge, again about 2 miles from the Atchafalaya Basin. Regularly went there as a young person in a pirogue with my confreres to explore the basin. So New Orleans, it has, like New Mexico, images that I feel can provoke the viewers. That's where there's so many visitors that come to New Mexico and to Louisiana. While they're both very different in their differences, they're in a way very much the same because they're out of the norm of what we normally experience. After Katrina, which had a big impact on me personally, I wanted to go down and try to do something. I could not receive the money at that time to make a film. In retrospect, I think that was a fortunate event. Ray Jimenez and I used to go down, with the regularity of a couple of times a year to see what was going on in Louisiana. After the hurricane, of course, the image there looked like the destruction from a horrible hurricane. But 5 years out, the hurricane was in 2005. I got to shoot in 2010. Those devastated areas no longer looked like the devastation from a hurricane, but the ruins of modernity. It was like an enormous set that Hollywood couldn't build. So it was fortunate for the film that I didn't get to do what I wanted to do at the time I wanted to do it.
Having spent all these years making the film and the whole process of post-production that you're talking about, and now it's here, and now you're beginning to show it to people, and now you're perhaps looking at it again with the eyes of an artist who's finished the work. Do you see it differently than the way you were seeing it when you were conceiving of it and making it?
Not really, no. How do I say it? I don't so much make the films, I live them. So I've been living this film for the last 12 years, basically. It's like a child. You recognize your child when you see it, but you always expect that child to be have its own life. So since the film has been finished, which has been the beginning of late June of 2013, it had its world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival, and remarkably with the Toronto Symphony playing the score live. At that point, you get to see what, as it were, it was the coming out of this child. And of course it made me nervous, because you roll the dice at an event so big like that. The Toronto, there are 2,500 film festivals in the world or more. However, there are three big tents on the planet. That's not to say they're the most important, but they're certainly the biggest and attract the most attention. And that's the Cannes Festival, the Berlin Festival, and the Toronto Festival, of which the Toronto is the largest. To be there in the middle of that three-ring circus, where 12 Years a Slave and all the other films that are now being talked about for nomination or viewing, and to have the kind of audience and response that this film got, is only extremely gratifying. We also have a distributor, Cinedigm, a new company. There were older and bigger companies that wanted to buy the film, but I felt we could have got lost in their shuffle. So we went with a newer company, a company that was anxious and emotionally involved with distributing the film. And for a film like this, it's going to open in the next several weeks in about 30 cities in North America. It'll also be opening live in Sydney at the Sydney Opera House with the Sydney Symphony.
So it's like a silent movie where the music is played live.
Right, and its live performance is being handled by a group called CAMI, Columbia Artists Management Inc. in New York, that books orchestras and performing acts all over the world. Remarkably, they took an interest in this film. They approached me and said we could make this available to orchestras all over the world to lease, and they're well on the road to doing that. It'll play in Guadalajara in March, Copenhagen. Moscow is considering it for their international festival at the end of June. It's being thought about in the Far East, the Middle East as well. So I can only feel gratified that other people or taking this film and giving it its best shot, being performed live as well as getting in real theaters all over the world, not only in the United States and Canada, but it'll be released in foreign countries as an agent handling that.
The film has been out for enough time that you have probably gotten responses, and I don't mean from critics, but from ordinary people.
The film has not played in, let's say, a ticketed venue yet. So we don't know what the public response is yet. We have had, however, probably over, let's say, at least 20 screenings for press on both coasts in the United States and in Canada. I don't tally it, but I would have to say, remarkably for me, that the response has been overwhelmingly positive. What does that mean? That doesn't mean that everyone had the same point of view about it or that everyone can speak about it, but it's been talked about as everything from a Zen meditation to something indescribable, but it moved me. So for a film without words, a film that has none of the traditions of theatrical or entertainment film, this film is kind of pushing critics, pushing those that have seen it so far to come up with a new way of defining. And it's more about a process than about what the film is. So it's had so far a very interesting response. Of course, not everyone likes the film. If it did, that would make me nervous. It's not a mass man product. It's not for everybody, but it's a film that I think can find an audience, and I feel lucky that there's someone helping me and the group to find that audience.
I guess what I was wondering was, I mean, people have the opportunity to make meaning or interpret or feel the film in different ways, and there's as many ways as there are people who have seen it and who are going to see it. Have those responses been really all over the map?
All over the map. All over the map. There's been no one response to the film, which, is, let's say that I'm delighted about that. There is, if everyone had the same response, it wouldn't be the film I thought I was hoping to make.
I mean, for me, and I'm indulging myself a little bit here, but I felt so much about decay, death, transience, kind of ephemeral beauty, and it seems like a film that could not have been made by a young person. It seems like a film that is made by somebody who's lived a long life.
Well, while I'm an old guy in my mid-70s now, having grown up in Santa Fe, really, since I came here first when I was 13, and then came to live when I was 19, so I consider it home, yes, as an old person involved. I want to say, however, that I'm like a blind person. I work through the eyes of other people. Deaf person, work through the ears of others. Except for Dia Ray, who's also in his 70s, and my producer, Lawrence Taub, who's knocking that, and my associate director, John Kane, who's 50. Everybody else who worked on the film, except for Philip, are probably 30 and under. Having said that, please don't misunderstand this, but fortunately, I can't see myself. I do feel like a child. I feel hopelessly like a child at some time, like I've never grown up or matured. And I think being childlike is a big asset in being able to make these films. There's a child within us all. While we might grow old in age, we still have that which is present from the beginning, and time is very short. Our time here is like a blink of an eye. So while one might be old in age, one perhaps, I'm not saying for myself, but for others certainly I've met, can be much more in the spirit and the joy and the openness of a child than those that are 20 or 30.
I guess what I meant by that was not to call you old, but rather to, I guess for me, there was a perception of a kind of appreciation of each little detail that we don't necessarily have so much when we're young.
Well, when you work on films as long as I've worked on this one, your commitment to do this is not with grace and gratuity, but more like to an insane asylum. As I said, I don't have a job. I live this. This is my life. I've often said to myself, I guess I can say it here, that if I can live long enough to complete the project I'm on, that started with Koyaanis Katsi a long time ago, then I feel like life has treated me very well. In the film, appreciating the small detail comes out for me in terms of the perfected image. Koyaanis Katsi had almost 400 images. Powa Katsi had almost 500 images. Nakoi Katsi had almost 600 images. the normal Hollywood film probably has several thousand images, a cut every 3 to 5 seconds. In this film, the detail is extraordinary because in 87 minutes, there are only 74 images.
Right.
Each image, well, of the 74 images, 72 are highly affected, but that's hidden in plain sight. To make the film as black as possible takes an enormous amount of time. To render that gorilla just 3 times in the film takes 2 people working on it almost 6 months. If you're going to take the gorilla out of the background and put in the background, you'll notice the gorilla, like us, has all these hairs. Each hair has to be dealt with. You can't just make a quick cut around. It would all look phony. So it has to have the appearance of something that the gorilla is actually in the background. It's all about illusion. Also, I know as a filmmaker, film is a flat medium. It's a two-dimensional medium. The deeper the blacks, the more the illusion of dimensionality. That all takes time to craft. So the crafting in this film, while only 74 images, probably took more time than any of the other films I've worked on. Each one was like a film within itself, each image completely by itself, as if it could stand on its own. So the amount of work that the crew put into it, way beyond my capacity, is for me awesome.
Do you have another film in mind?
Yes, I do. Or let's say it has me in mind. It's called Time. It's about the environment. It's not to give you information or enlighten you, your mind. It's aimed at the solar plexus so that one can be affected or feel the moment in which we're at, to feel the tipping point, not to be told about it. The focus of this film, well, first of all, let me back up. 99% of what's in the environment our eyes cannot see. They're limited. However, there are many instruments, from x-ray to thermal to infrared, etc., that allow one to see what the eye cannot see. I would like to be able to show the electromagnetic spectrum. I would like to be able to show things that, if the eye could see, might astound us, if not terrify us. If we could see right now in Santa Fe, just anywhere, the electromagnetic spectrum, if we looked down, we wouldn't even be able to see the feet beneath us because of all of the energy that exists within the environment in order to allow us the pursuit of our technological happiness. But what we don't see is just as real as what we see, that which is present but unseen. So it's how to bring that unseen to the eyes of those of us that can't see.
Godfrey Reggio's new film is called Visitors. It opens at the Screen Friday, the 31st of January at 7 o'clock. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for the invitation. Appreciate it.